Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, a weekly threat intelligence and information security podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest threat research team. My name is Stefano and I'm really glad to be back for another episode with you, and I'm in great company today as well because there's a great team here with me. We've got Kim, Brendan and Ivan. Hey guys, how are you doing?
Hello, good, thank you. Glad to be back as well.
Yeah.
Hey, doing not too good. Not too bad.
Good. Glad that everyone is doing well. Ivan is joining us for the first time, so it's debut on the podcast. So, yeah, do you want to give a brief introduction of yourself, of your role here at ReliaQuest?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. I'm super excited. So my name is Ivan. I'm a cyber threat intelligence analyst. Been here for just about a year. So, super excited. Think this is going to be a great podcast. So I'm thrilled.
Cool. Well, we're very glad to have you here after 1 year of listening to Shadow Talk. I'm sure every week now you got the opportunity to rise and shine. So welcome to this team as well. This week we've got a really interesting agenda because we will be talking about the new ransomware quarterly report delivered and published by ReliaQuest. So we'll go through the main points that we have analyzed and then have a discussion around that. Afterwards, we've got an update about the 3CX supply chain attack, which apparently was a supply chain attack of a supply chain attack. So that was something new for me to see and a pretty interesting cyber attack to analyze. And finally, we're going to have a discussion around the new report on the Russia-Ukraine cyber operations situation, which should have a good sort of, which should give us like a good overview of what happened and how Ukraine has responded to the various levels of cyber activity that we noticed in the last, 15 months, something like that. So it's a pretty long time frame there. And for the last section of this episode, we'll also be talking about some of the main insights that we gathered recently from deployments in the Russian language and English language cyber criminal scene. So there's a lot to talk about. I don't want you to get too tired of my voice pretty soon. So I'd say let's start talking about like the proper stuff so I can give space to you guys. So for the first section of the podcast, we will be talking about the new ransomware quarterly report that has just been published on our website, and you'll have the link to that in the show notes, in the resources of this podcast as well. So what happened is that last week we published our own ransomware Q1 threat report, apparently based on the findings that we gathered, based on the data that we gathered for the first quarter of 2023. This was the most prolific quarter that the threat research team has observed in terms of double extortion ransomware groups activity. So more victims were named on data leak sites than in any other quarter to date, which is a pretty scary thought to get there. And this was despite like an increased number of law enforcement operation and other challenges that ransomware operators had to face in 2022. Some key events include the attack campaign by Klopp that exploited the Go Anywhere MFT zero-day vulnerability that breached over 100 organizations. Then the FBI had an important seizure against like the Hive ransomware gang servers. And even though Lockbit remained at the top of the pyramid in terms of number of attack committed, we've seen Klopp getting back to the podium, second place, thanks to that Go Anywhere exploitation. So enough with my voice. Kim, can you tell us more about this report and what kind of is the state of ransomware nowadays based on the findings that we highlighted now?
Sure. So I think, you know, first of all, to say this is an unprecedented level of ransomware attacks that we've observed from the first quarter. So I don't know at the moment if the cyber criminals are going to be able to sustain that level of activity. And it does just go to show with Klopp and their vulnerability exploitation that the activity of one group can have a massive impact on what happens in a single quarter. So I think without Klopp's go anywhere exploitation, would the numbers have been as big as they were? Possibly not. And like the last time Klopp did something like this was, I think, 2021 when they exploited Excellion and an Excellion vulnerability. So it could well be a real peak, and then maybe we're going to see a trough, or we did see a trough from the last quarter because it was surprisingly quiet at the end of 2022. I think also interestingly that law enforcement operations, although the activity they did with Hive was great, I think they stopped the payment of over $100 million ransom with that activity, but it hasn't had a significantly detrimental impact to the ransomware scene as a whole. Another interesting point from this quarter's report was that pure data extortion activity had significantly declined, like we barely saw any, but that was due to the Carica hacking team just not really doing anything this quarter. So again, that will be interesting to see next quarter if they were just taking a break, or maybe whether they have been disrupted or decided to shut down. But in terms of kind of what we do know, I think we can safely say that Lockbit will continue to be a prominent feature in the ransomware scene for a while. I think the regions that are most targeted, the sectors that are most targeted, are highly likely to stay the same throughout the rest of the year. So, yeah, I think that's the most interesting points I took from the report.
Nice. Thank you, Kim. I think it's interesting, like what you were mentioning about the fact that, you know, last quarter was a little bit more calm in a way in terms of ransomware activity. Then we see this new quarter being like really active. And I think it sort of speaks to the fact that, you know, the cyber threat landscape moves really fast, and it's really important to track, like, with, you know, with timelines specified at the beginning of the year or the beginning of your intelligence planning collection, in order to stay updated with everything relevant that happens there. Because, you know, this quarter, maybe, you know, pure extortion groups were not really active, but that's not an indication that they're not going to be very active next quarter at all, actually. So it will be interesting to see how things will change in the future. Another thing that I wanted to discuss with you guys is the sort of vulnerabilities that were mentioned in this report. So what kind of vulnerabilities did we see exploited by ransomware groups in the last quarter as we speak about this report?
You already mentioned Klopp's exploitation of the vulnerability in Go Anywhere. So that was a zero-day vulnerability that didn't require authentication to exploit and enabled the threat actors to remotely execute code on compromised systems. So that vulnerability does have a patch, but obviously Klopp were able to get in and compromise well over 130 organizations. And I think they posted like 99 victims to their data leak site within March alone. So that shows the percentage of victims that they're actually posting to their data leak site, which I thought was quite high, interestingly high. So are they not engaging in negotiation, or is their negotiation tactic not that great, so no one pays up? But interestingly, they also didn't encrypt people's networks. They just went for the data theft. So you could say in that respect, they're kind of keeping the tally for pure extortion going in Carica's absence. But maybe that had something to do with people not paying the ransoms and ending up on the data leak sites. I mean, there just wasn't a negotiation to begin with. And then outside of them, I think we also observed a code execution flaw in IBM Aspera FastSpecs. It's quite hard to say. Being exploited to to deploy both the Icefire and the Beauty ransomware.
Well, thank you. That was very comprehensive. In terms of how we as ReliQuest manage the risk of ransom operations for our customers, what can you guys tell us? I think, Brandon, you may be the most suitable one for this question here.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different mechanisms that ReliQuest uses to help manage the risk of the threat of ransomware. And we do it through two different angles, externally and internally. So obviously with the acquisition of Digital Shadows, ReliQuest now has that full 365 degree view of the threat landscape. And we can really narrow that focus in on the ransomware landscape as well. So from the external side, you know, we put a lot of effort into monitoring the ransomware leak sites for any third-party risk that may be introduced as an organization may fall victim to a ransomware incident. We also are monitoring the extortion sites, Telegram channels that these actors are using, Russian market spaces. I know Avant's with us today. He'll dive a little bit deeper into that. And also developing what we call tippers internally, initial access broker tippers. We know that initial access brokers play a huge role in facilitating successful ransomware campaigns. So we do a lot on the external side. Also on the internal side, from a detection standpoint, a response standpoint, an investigation standpoint. So monitoring exposed services, right? So we know RDP, VNC, SSH, like all these protocols that may be exposed externally to the internet. We see initial access brokers or ransomware affiliates kind of going through the path of least resistance to get into a network. And these are definitely means. So a lot of monitoring on these common loader malware frameworks that usually end up are with ransomware. So think Stock Ghoulish, think Qbot, think Emotet, Iced ID, Gootloader. There's a million out there, right? But we put a lot of focus on these particular malwares in general when we're looking and trying to classify the ransomware threat. Moving on, like at ReliQuest, we like to use a detect left methodology. So trying to detect as far left on a kill chain, or if you're looking at a MITRE attack, a MITRE attack framework, hunting or detecting as far left as possible with our interest in combating dwell time. So looking at reconnaissance activity, you know, if I see NL test or reg query or some Active Directory PowerShell commandlets, we're looking for signs of upon initial access, discovery operations being conducted by said actors, common persistence mechanisms, C2 frameworks. We do a lot of collection, a lot of detection around common C2 frameworks like Cobalt Strike, Sliver, Brute Rotel, lateral movement, you know, whether it's RDP, PSExec, WinRM, WMI. There's a bunch of different ways to do this. There's a lot of variation between actors and affiliate programs. They're pretty common in the way that they move laterally, the way that they're conducting their operations. But then we get a little bit more focused on like particular objectives of said groups. So pivoting to a domain controller, whether they're making use of NTDS util or VSS admin to interact with the NTDS.dit file to harvest credentials, whether it's Lockbit that's using Steelbit for exfiltration, or maybe Blackbost or another ransomware gang making use of Arclone or Megasync. There's a ton of different ways that ReliQuest helps manage the risk of ransomware, both from an external and internal perspective, with really focusing on detection as early as possible upon initial access.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. That was very comprehensive. And it was really interesting to see, you know, the sort of combination of different approaches that are taken within ReliQuest to combat this threat, both from like a detection point of view, then from an intelligence point of view, in order to prevent and mitigate the threat posed by these groups as much as possible. So We talked about ransomware in our report, but now let's move to that supply chain over supply chain attack that we mentioned in the beginning of the episode. Because as you may remember from our previous episodes or from your daily jobs anyway, at the end of March, security researchers reported malicious activity originating from a legitimate signed version of the 3CX desktop client. The activity included beaconing to threat actor controlled infrastructure, second stage payload deployment, and in some instances, hands-on keyboard activity. The malicious activity was attributed to the Lazarus Group, which is a North Korean national state threat group, which has demonstrated in the past both espionage activity and financially motivated activity. The group was observed using this Trojanite 3CX desktop client for a supply chain attack. So this was the recap. Now, what happened? This week, security researchers at Mandiant identified that the initial compromise vector of this 3CX network was via malicious software downloaded from the Trading Technologies website. So again, a legitimate website, a legitimate software. And this was the first time that Mandiant and myself as well has seen a software supply chain attack leading to another supply chain attack. So that was pretty interesting for me to study and like to learn to read because, yeah, I never seen anything like that before. I got to admit that it was really cool and also really scary because, you know, if you can think of a threat actor like chaining different sort of intrusions and malware at this level, it's pretty staggering in my opinion. But yeah, so is this the first time that you guys have seen this breadth of an attack? That was pretty impressive, wasn't it?
Yes, so this is definitely the first time I've heard of a software supply chain compromise lead to another software supply chain compromise. However, it's not the first time I've seen a third party compromise lead or trickle down to other organizations. You know, we've seen in BC cases, a compromised third party may send a phishing email infecting an affiliate organization, resulting in an attack chain repeating itself. And likewise, there have been several cases of professional service organizations being compromised, their customers then becoming compromised along with the customers of those customers. So it's kind of like an inception, but definitely on the software supply chain angle, this is, at least in my time, the first record of a software supply chain compromise leading to another software supply chain compromise.
Like, you know, we often tell clients or, you know, listeners to the podcast, you know, to have like a solid and robust risk assessment plan and business continuity plan for these situations. But we usually talk about like single supply chain attacks, you know. So how do we adapt these plans in light of what we've seen with this new 3CX news?
Yeah, so unfortunately, there's no easy answer to combating the threat of a software supply chain compromise. However, as you mentioned, Stefano, there are definitely ways organizations can implement measures to reduce the risk. This starts with, as you had mentioned, identifying the software that's used within your organization, building a robust inventory for both current and future software purchases that your organization is making, and then conducting an assessment of how each of these software components will operate within your environment. This evaluation could include responsibility, ownership of the software, frequency of updates, whether this software provider, you know, follows like a standard software development lifecycle, the patch availability, et cetera. And with that assessment, once you've comprehended your portfolio per se, it's important that you develop a playbook of steps to take it as if what I would do in the event that this software were to be compromised. Like, what does it touch? How does it communicate on the network? How do I identify the asset owners, etc., so that when and if this were to ever be compromised, it's not a fire drill. It's you have a set of plans. Just as an organization would build out an incident response plan, the same could be built for, you know, the software that your organization uses. In the case of 3CX, this is a little bit tricky because it seems that the user downloaded the X trading software that was likely not an approved software and therefore may have missed the process that I had illustrated earlier. So that process only works for software that you know about that fits your organization's acceptable use policy. And I, you know, I don't work for 3CX. I can't speak on behalf of 3CX. I don't know whether or not they use that similar process, but or if whether or not this trading platform was actually met their acceptable use policy. But in the event that it's not, you know, organizations, really what it comes down to is prevention of software downloads that don't meet your organization's acceptable use policy. So with the implementation of controls like application whitelisting and restricting local admin privileges on managed assets, organizations could begin to reduce the risk in particular, and funnel the software download requests through a process as I highlighted earlier. So really limiting the threat that a user can download software that doesn't go through that rigorous process I had mentioned earlier, those types of controls an organization could definitely begin to evaluate and implement within standard processes to prevent something like this in the future.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. I think it's really important. It is a difficult one because, of course, as you were saying, there are a lot of processes and controls that need to be in place and that need to be followed by a huge amount of people, especially when you think of, you know, organizations that have thousands of employees. But it's definitely one of those things that really pays off in the long run. So, yeah, thank you for that, Brandon. I think we can move to the third section of today's podcast, where we will be talking about like the latest, well, one of the latest, at least in case I missed something over the past couple of days, reports on the Russia-Ukraine war. In this case, there was a new report from the European Cyber Conflict Research Initiative that shed some light on the recent and like also the long-term dynamics of the cyber conflict between Russia and Ukraine. In this report, the researchers highlighted the sort of significant attacks and operations that Russia carried out in the past 15 months, but also the determination of Ukraine in sort of defending against these attacks. So, Kim, I know you've done some work on this report in the past few days. So can you tell us more about some of the key findings of this report and what you thought of it?
Yeah, of course. So just to set the scene, this the ECCRI, they're a collection of European analysts that kind of got together in a workshop. And this report was the outcome of that workshop. So it's like the highlights, basically. And the report was commissioned by the UK's National Cybersecurity Centre, which is why then it's now been publicised and it's getting some attention kind of across the media. So some of the main takeaways from it were that Russia was probably underprepared for the war at the beginning. You know, we kind of assessed at the time that maybe that was because they thought it was going to be an easy win over Ukraine and maybe didn't need to use cyber offensives when actually it was good, just going to be a quick war and that would be it. But actually, what they've observed since is that Russia moved with speed and flexibility and hit Ukraine with an unprecedented volume of attacks across the last 15 months. But as you said, Ukraine has been well prepared in contrast and has had a very resilient cyber defense that's managed to withstand that high tempo of attacks. Also, interestingly, Russia's GRU took a predominant role in this cyber offensive. So that's Russia's military intelligence service. And then we more typically would see like Russia's internal intelligence service, the FSB, conducting more offensive cyber attacks. So there'd been some kind of stuff in the news about whether this group, with this agency, was trying to assert some dominance. So that's an interesting point. And then one of the other key takeaways was one we've discussed before on the pod and within the team as well, that just the blurred lines that are continuing to develop between, you know, state-sponsored groups, cyber criminal groups, and also now politically motivated groups with the resurgence of hacktivism.
Now, that was probably one of the most interesting sort of information bits that we gathered during this war from like a cyber point of view, the sort of, yeah, the convergence of like these different groups with different motivations that eventually found a way to, in a way, cooperate or at least share some targets and intentions in the past months. So what the report highlighted as well is that some of the initial beliefs that we had, at least that we were maintaining before and in the initial weeks of this war, were not entirely correct. And it was also, like, for me personally, like, going through that was a really sort of a really good experience in terms of learning about my, you know, cognitive biases and really be open to alternative views that were coming from the actual data that we were seeing. But can you tell us more about what the report included in that sense?
Yeah, like I said, this is a really good exercise in kind of looking back at what all analysts were probably doing at the beginning of the war, trying to make assessments, trying to make predictions. So it's a really good exercise in that. As I mentioned, there wasn't really a lot of cyber activity at the beginning of the war, and we made the judgment that maybe that was premeditated, had been thought out. But actually now, with the benefit of hindsight, so it's not to say that the judgments we made back then are wrong, but it's just what was most likely with the information we had at the time. That maybe Russia just needed a bit of time to prepare and to ramp up their cyber operations, because what we've seen kind of since then has been quite a consistent and measured targeting. They also suggested that maybe the cyber activity happening alongside the kinetic activity possibly wasn't planned, possibly could have been chance, opportunism. And it's just really about, you know, Western observers not placing too much emphasis on Russia being highly organized or strategic planning, all that kind of stuff, and that actually this has been a bit more of a mishmashed attempt at cyber warfare. And then, as I mentioned, like, Russia has previously been seen as a very reckless adversary that was initially brought about by the NotPetya attacks, just spinning wildly out of control. And what we've seen with the Russia-Ukraine war is that they've been conducting attacks very quickly, you targeting edge devices to get initial access very quickly, having a high turnover of attacks, and also like burning through their sources. Like, in the last year, there's been a lot more reporting of APT campaigns than we would normally see, because they're there to be stealthy and to have persistence for a long time. And again, so we just kind of thought that was recklessness, but maybe now with the hindsight and the information we have, that this was actually just the GRU trying to prove itself as a cyber operator within Russia, rather than anything more sinister.
That's an interesting take on it, because I imagine that the GRU, but like any sort of military entity in Ukraine or Russia, has been under immense pressure in the past year and something more, 15 months. So I can see how that may happen. You know, you're continually pressured for results, and you try everything that you can, even, you know, burning some of the accesses that you've been sort of growing for a long time. And, you know, we were talking about sort of predictions before and sort of what we thought at the beginning of the war and how it turned out to be. And in terms of predictions moving forward, so like 15 months in this war, what did the ECCRI identify as possibilities in the short and medium term going forward?
So the report was mainly just about looking back on what had happened, but there were some insights into what might happen in the future. One of them being that Russia will almost certainly continue to focus its cyber operations on Ukraine for at least the rest of this year. And in doing so, they will continue to develop their capabilities. But what was interesting in the report was that those capabilities are likely to continue being the simple wiping malware that we've seen so far in the war. Those are easy to develop for the GRU, who's not that experienced in this, and they are also easy to discard. So you don't have to put loads of effort into it, and it doesn't matter if you have to let go and not use it anymore. So I think we'll probably continue to see that quick turnover of victims, in and out type thing. And yeah, just unfortunately, Russia is not going to let up anytime soon.
Yeah, that's unfortunate and also like highly likely, in my opinion. And do you agree with their assessment? Like, wiper malware, as you say, fairly easy to develop, at least for like these sort of groups with this level of sophistication and resources as well. But yeah, do you see anything else? Because like what I'm thinking is, and we can link back to the first section of this podcast, that we may see sort of an increase of use of ransomware attacks against Ukrainian entities, and that collaboration of different groups with different motivations that we discussed just a little bit before. Do you agree with that? Do you have any other thoughts that you want to share on this topic?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we talked about that kind of blurring of lines between the motivations of different groups. And we've also observed in the last year, you know, Russian APT groups deploying ransomware on their victims, as well as conducting cyber espionage. So I definitely think ransomware is within the toolkit of Russian groups to use on Ukraine. It's highly effective. That's why ransomware groups do it. Sorry, what was your second point?
Just if you had like any other thoughts on what could happen in the future. Of course, everything related to cyber, at least for the moment, depends on what happens on the battlefield, like on the ground. But yeah, if you had any general thoughts that you wanted to share.
I do have one more. The most interesting takeaway from this report, I think, is that they were very keen to point out that although we now learned all of this about the Russia-Ukraine war, that we can't just take a copy paste and apply these lessons to any other conflict that might occur throughout the world. So for example, with China and Taiwan, like, it's different adversaries, it's different parties involved. So this gives a good insight into Russia's cyber operations, but doesn't necessarily help with using cyber in modern war.
I also read like on the report like a particularly interesting line about what you were just mentioning, and that was the fact that like even if we're looking at other conflicts involving Russia, it still may not apply in the same way because of Russia's geographical proximity with Ukraine, as if those two characteristic, but like the geographical part and the cyber like tightly intertwined. So that was interesting to read, because yeah, it involved some parts of, you know, analytical thinking that I may have not been taking completely into account. So that was again cool in order to learn more about how our brain works and all that kind of stuff, which may be a bit nerdy, but that's how my brain works. So there you go, you will listen to it. So thank you for that, Kim. And let's move to the fourth and final section of today's episode. And now we'll be talking a little bit about our internal perspectives as the RelyQuest threat research team into all different and various investigations into the cyber criminal ecosystem. So Ivan, that's your time to shine. I saw you were a bit silent today, but it was your first episode. I was super anxious, my first episode. And just by not saying anything, you still have done way better than what I did on my first episode. So let's see now, what can you tell us? And specifically, can you give us an overview into what our team has observed into cyber criminal forums in the past months?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the last probably 2 months or so, I'd say like March and April, specifically, our team kind of noticed a decline of activity just throughout the entire, you know, forum landscape, which is, you know, not surprising. I mean, there's waves that go up and down, but it's especially been quiet this time around. You know, we look at a lot of sections on forums. We go, you know, through all that, we analyze. But what's really interesting is some of the most popular sections, especially ones where, you know, threat actors are sharing or advertising vulnerabilities and exploits and POCs and all of that, they're very quiet. I mean, those sections were super popular, had a lot of interaction. So our analysts definitely noticed a huge decline there. It's unsure why. It could be a variety of different reasons. But we also noticed that kind of decline bleeding into larger operations such as initial access brokers and the way that they kind of conduct their operations. So in the past, our team has seen that IABs will be sharing just basic information that they find from Zoom info, like the geography of the corporate access that they're selling, the sector, the revenue, and some basic system information. And recently there's been kind of a turn where they're not providing as much information. So they might just include like, you know, this is the country and this is the sector, but there's no other information. So, you know, based on our team's analysis, it could be a lot to do with other researchers on the forums kind of burning those accesses and making those IABs a lot less credible. So that's one perspective. And there has been chatter about that in the past, that, you know, a threat actor will provide way too much information. Somebody kind of discovers what that company access is, and then they reach out to that company, let them know that this is the situation, and then that access is no longer valid. So that kind of doesn't look very good on them. So those are kind of the big changes that we've seen and kind of discussed in the past, I'd say, 2 months. That's kind of the biggest things.
Well, that's very interesting, because like when I think of initial access brokers, I rely on Quest Now and before Digital Shadows, we did a lot of research on that. And we sort of saw like the evolution of this threat group, these threat actors, which at the beginning, as you were saying, it was sort of immature as a cyber criminal model, but it's now more sophisticated. They have, generally speaking, learned more about operational security and what to disclose and what not to disclose, which makes our job as security researchers much more difficult. It makes their job as sellers quite more difficult as well, because, you know, if you're interested in buying something, you want to have as many details as possible. But it is sort of unexpected and necessary evolution in that front, because otherwise you would just burn all your access all the time. So that was interesting for me. Another thing that I wanted to ask you is about breach forums. As you may know, breach forums is a very highly popular English language cyber criminal forum, which was very active. It had a lot of threat actors and threat groups operating there. And it was taken down by law enforcement in the past months. So what happened then? So my question for you, Ivan, is sort of, what happened to all those English language cyber criminals that were active on that platform. Do we know where did they move, or is it still uncertain in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no concrete replacement that our team has discovered. I mean, we've seen advertisements and promotions for cyber criminal forums. You know, surprisingly, even on Twitter, there was, you know, posts of administrators saying, hey, I'm starting this new forum. But it turned out a lot of those were just honeypots, and the threat actors kind of realized that. So I think with breach forums and, you know, Genesis Market, all of those kind of going down, I think the administrators, especially of forums that are interested in starting, you know, replacements, are kind of taking that into consideration, that this might be kind of a hot topic right now. So it's not something to jump into. You know, you don't want to get caught. Same thing with these threat actors. I mean, they start realizing that something's a honeypot, you know, something might be related to law enforcement. So, you know, they don't want to jump on that right away without just kind of having that credibility of the forum. Interestingly, though, there's a forum as well called RAMP, which focuses on ransomware, which had a registration fee prior to the shutdowns. And in the past few months, it's kind of slowed down. There hasn't been much activity on there. But our team has recently discovered that they had taken off the registration fee, which I believe was quite hefty. The administrator has also started posting on other forums, kind of promoting that and saying, hey, we're going to start getting more popular. Everyone feel free to join. So that is definitely an option. And since then, our team has noticed kind of an uptick in activity on that forum. Another kind of interesting thing is on XSS, for example, their kind of landscape is very Russian speaking, kind of they're pro that, and very kind of anti other languages that we've seen in the past, especially for English speakers. There's been threads, you know, where threat actors are discussing not working with English speakers, kind of having that negative view, and even going as far as saying that, you know, there should be a forum-wide ban of English speakers. But since breach forums kind of went down, on the login page of XSS, there is a big banner now that says, welcome guests, please follow the rules. Otherwise, you know, you're going to get banned. And then they have that little link to their rules, which they take quite seriously. They're very kind of have that authority there, and not a lot of stuff goes through that shouldn't be. So that is definitely kind of an indicator for our team that, you know, chances are that a lot of breach forum users are kind of migrating over to other forums that have that credibility, that have that like long standing, including XSS. So that's definitely a possibility. Otherwise, like I said, it's right now there's not like a concrete replacement. As we've seen with raid forums, breach forums took a little bit to kind of take traction. There was other forums that came up. I think Raid Forums 2 it was called, which pretty much died within a couple weeks. So I think it's just a little bit of time that we need to wait and see what exactly happens, what comes out of it. So, but yeah, definitely interesting developments, just because, like I said, I mean, previously there was such a not hatred, but there you could tell that, you know, threat actors were very against working with English speakers on Russian language forums. And now they're kind of accepting that. And I think the landscape is changing. So, yeah, that's kind of been the main things that we've noticed about, you know, where users are migrating to.
Well, that's very interesting, like to sort of see the shift in the cyber criminal ecosystem in the way they cooperate and collaborate beyond, you know, language barriers or like preconceptions about how the language that a person speaks influences their actions. So thank you for that. And yeah, just wanted to open the floor for any last thoughts or bits of research that you wanted to share with us before we close the episode. Do you have anything else that you want to share with us?
Nothing from me.
I think, yeah, like I said, kind of going back to that previous one, just wanted to kind of mention a couple of things that, you know, the decline that we see could kind of come back to, you know, the fact of the matter is that these threat actors are not, they're not dumb. They see that the law enforcement is getting involved with all of the, you know, cyber criminal activity. And, you know, there's been reports that especially Russian speaking threat actors are kind of worried about their own safety, especially with the war going on. And there's been even reports that, you know, if you get caught doing some minor activities, there is, you know, the chance that you will be sent to the front lines. And I'm sure that nobody wants to do that. And I think that's just the biggest thing. And but yeah, definitely keep monitoring all of that and see where, you know, where the future takes it.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, Ivan. I think we're all looking forward to have you on the podcast again and inform us about what's going to happen in the next few months. Brendan, Kim, any last thoughts? Anything you want to share?
No, I already jumped in too soon. I didn't have anything else, so I'm just going to stop talking.
I want to double check that.
Yeah, no, nothing from my side. Really appreciate, again, the time today. And thanks, Yvonne, for hopping on. I think that the insight that you provided is something fresh that I hope the listeners out there enjoy and be interested to, you know, any feedback that you guys have on this, something that you guys want to see more of, let us know. Definitely want to be able to bring on some new faces to the pod and help show the behind the scenes of what the ReliQuest research team is up to.
Well, yeah, that's a very good shout. Thanks, Brendan. And yeah, so that's everything from us. Everything that we discussed today, you'll find some interesting resources and at the bottom of the episode. Again, Ivan, very good job on your first appearance. You've done a really impressive participation. So thank you very much for that. And thanks, everyone. And thanks also to the audience too. I've arrived at the end of the episode. So anyway, a lot of thanks, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.